From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Antibiotics aren't always as effective as they used to be. Bacteria are fighting back with new resistant strains. On today's Fresh Air, how the overuse of antibiotics has created strains of bacteria that antibiotics can't kill. We talk with Dr. Stuart Levy, author of The Antibiotic Paradox and president of the Alliance for Prudent Use of Antibiotics. Also today, the aftermath of America's atomic testing. We talk with former Congressman and Secretary of the Interior, Stuart Udall. He was one of the first lawyers to represent Americans who were injured or killed by the testing of atomic weapons. And Maureen Corrigan reviews the new biography of writer Kay Boyle by Joan Mellon. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The Georgia Court of Appeals has thrown out a jury's $10 million award against General Motors. The case stemmed from the death of a teenager in a GMC pickup explosion. The truck had fuel tanks mounted on the side. The court said the teenager's family improperly kept referring to the 120 similar lawsuits pending against GM. But no evidence linking those other cases to the teenagers was ever presented. References to other cases can only be used if the similarities have been legally okayed. A federal jury has cleared the way for a punitive damage suit against the Exxon company and Exxon Valdez Captain Joseph Hazelwood. Jurors have decided that both Exxon and Hazelwood were reckless and to blame for the 1989 Valdez oil spill. The verdict means the plaintiffs can go ahead with their request for $15 billion in punitive damages. President and Mrs. Clinton have given testimony under oath to Special Prosecutor Robert Fisk. He's heading up the Whitewater Special Investigation. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
According to a statement by White House counsel Lloyd Cutler, Special Counsel Robert Fisk came to the White House yesterday and interviewed both President and Mrs. Clinton. They both answered questions under oath about the events surrounding the death of Vincent Foster and the meetings and phone calls between Treasury and White House staff concerning the investigation into the connection between a failed Arkansas savings and loan and a real estate company owned by the Clintons. According to Cutler, Fisk has requested that the White House disclose no further details about the interviews. Fisk is reported to be close to finishing his report on the first phase of his investigation, Foster's death and the discussions between White House staff and Treasury officials. Once that report is issued, it will clear the way for congressional hearings on Whitewater. However, the remainder of Fisk's investigation could take a year or more. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
The New York Times is reporting a majority of countries in the Western Hemisphere would support military action against Haiti if sanctions fail. Dick Hinchliffe of member station WNYC reports.
The Times quotes senior Clinton administration officials who say leaders from as many as 30 Latin American and Caribbean nations have expressed qualified support for U.S. military intervention if sanctions fail to topple Haiti's military government. One top administration official says some countries are prepared to join a multilateral force if such action is deemed necessary. Several countries previously opposed to military action have reportedly reversed their positions because of increased repression by the Haitian military and the country's apparent contempt for international efforts to mediate a return to democracy. Several countries attending an Organization of American States meeting last week said they would support an invasion only if the United Nations or the OAS approved it. Last Friday, President Clinton stepped up sanctions by prohibiting commercial flights and financial commerce between Haiti and the U.S. For National Public Radio, I'm Dick Hinchliffe in New York.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are up almost 9 points. This is NPR. North Korea says it's withdrawing from the International Atomic Energy Agency. Pyongyang says it won't let IAEA inspectors into the country anymore. The announcement was released by the North Korean Foreign Ministry. The North has been under growing pressure to admit inspectors to check its nuclear program. The United States has been pressing for international sanctions since the North rejected the inspectors. The North says it will view sanctions as an act of war. Researchers say treating heavy users of cocaine is the most cost-effective way to cut consumption. A new study released today suggests the U.S. should make a dramatic shift in how it spends its money to fight drug abuse. NPR's John Greenberg reports.
The study by the RAND Drug Policy Research Center says cocaine consumption has held steady at nearly 300 metric tons per year since the mid-1980s, even though the number of users has dropped by nearly 2 million. Researchers say treating heavy users is the key to reining in cocaine demand. They say if the country wanted to cut consumption by 1%, the least expensive route would be treatment at a price of $34 million. Law enforcement tactics would cost 7 times as much, and the price tag of stopping cocaine at its source would be more than 20 times as high. Researchers point out America today spends less than 10% of its anti-drug efforts on treatment. This is John Greenberg in Washington.
President Clinton has addressed mayors from the largest American cities today by satellite. The U.S. Conference of Mayors is meeting in Portland, Oregon this week. They want to know how the president will create jobs and fight crime. They also asked him how hiring more police officers would help. The mayors are worried their cities will have to pay for all of the president's ideas. The mayors are also going to vote on Mr. Clinton's welfare overhaul bill. The conference supports the overall measure, but certain leaders don't like particular parts of it. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Some of us would be dead if it weren't for antibiotics. These drugs kill minor infections, as well as infections which used to be life-threatening, such as certain forms of pneumonia, venereal disease, and tuberculosis. But now there are strains of bacteria that are resistant to antibiotics, a frightening development for doctors and patients. Paradoxically, this resistance has been created by the overuse of antibiotics. My guest, Dr. Stuart Levy, is going to explain how this happened and what we can do to reverse the trend. Dr. Levy is the president of the International Alliance for Prudent Use of Antibiotics. He chaired a study of antibiotic use and resistance around the world. He's a professor at Tufts University School of Medicine and a staff physician at the New England Medical Center. He's also the author of the book, The Antibiotic Paradox. I asked him which infections have become more difficult to treat.
Bacteria causing infections of the ear, which are no longer susceptible or killed by the antibiotics we used to be able to treat them with, and bacteria that make skin infections, urinary tract infections, and so forth, are what we call resistant. And this phenomenon is not just in the United States, but is currently worldwide.
So are there people who have urinary tract infections and ear infections that can't be cured?
For the moment, most people with urinary tract infections and ear infections can be cured, but they may have to go to the fourth or fifth antibiotic. By that time, of course, their suffering has increased, and much to our dismay, some of the children may have to have surgery because the antibiotics are not really hitting the organism.
Are there old diseases that are returning? I'm thinking particularly of tuberculosis. There's now a type of tuberculosis caused by an antibiotic-resistant strain of bacteria. Is this happening with other old diseases that are coming back?
Well, there are old disease organisms, like the causing tuberculosis, which have come back. The tuberculosis organism, Bacillus is what we call it, is a good example because we thought we had gotten rid of it, and now it's coming back, but in new fury with resistance to 8, 9, 10 different antibiotics. There are other kinds of bacteria that we've been keeping at bay for a long time, such as the pneumococcus, which can cause ear infections, or the gonococcus that can cause gonorrhea, the staphylococcus that causes skin infections, and the fact is they may not be coming back, but they're harder to treat, and to some extent, maybe because we don't hit them the first time, they spread to other people, and so the infection rate may be a little larger.
Let's talk about some of the ways in which this problem of resistance was created. Do you think antibiotics were overused?
I clearly believe antibiotics were overused, are being overused, and that a large component of the overuse lies in the patient, him or herself. Physicians will often tell me that patients demand their antibiotics. They even will demand them by name and dosage. The patients say, we want that antibiotic. We know that that antibiotic will cure us, though they don't know, in fact, that antibiotics are developed for treating bacteria, not viruses. So you have this demand by the patient, the physician wanting to do well by the patient, and I think incorrectly giving in to the demands. But after all, as I certainly expect, physicians are like everyone else. They want to treat the patient. They think, well, maybe the patient could be right. antibiotics are probably unique medications in which the patient really plays physician and argues often with the physician at the same level. And I think this is really very curious and has been a leading cause of the misuse of these drugs and the myth created around them that they are so miraculous that they do no harm and I can use them virtually at whim.
Now, I know a lot of people will, they'll get, say, a round of 2 weeks' worth of antibiotics, and if they feel better in 7 days, they'll say, well, I think I'm all cured, so I don't need to take these pills anymore. That's a pretty dangerous thing to do, isn't it, to just stop in the middle of a round?
Yes. The dosage of antibiotics is given both in the amount and the time period as a result of lots of studies on lots of people to determine how much is needed and for how long to get rid of every last bacterium. If you stop the treatment, what happens is you kill off most of the bacteria. But one should realize that when you get an infection, it's not with one or two bacteria. You're talking about millions of bacteria. Otherwise, you wouldn't be sick. So you kill off thousands and thousands, but there's still plenty left. And those that survive are the ones that have survived. So they're somewhat less susceptible to the antibiotic that you've been using. They can grow back. Now, they're just a little bit more or maybe a lot more resistant. So when you try to go back again, you can't treat it. You got to go to another drug. Now, in your case, it may happen to you, the patient. On the other hand, while you're sort of going through this period of no antibiotic, having shortened the course, you still have the bacteria in you. They can go on to somebody else who now, if their defenses are down, develops an infection. But they don't have the super sensitive type. They might have that one which is now resistant. And so when they start the treatment, they can't be treated.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Stuart Levy. He's the author of the book, The Antibiotic Paradox, How Miracle Drugs Are Destroying the Miracle. He's also the president of the International Alliance for the Prudent Use of Antibiotics. Is there a description you could give for those of us who don't know a lot about science that would help explain how bacteria manage to change in a way that they can resist antibiotics?
Antibiotics were developed to kill or stop the growth of bacteria without harming the cells in our own body. That's why they're so miraculous, something that is unique to killing a bacterium. However, bacteria under the siege of an antibiotic can either mutate spontaneously so that that target that the antibiotic was directed to is no longer there or changed, or they can pick up in the environment a trait which allows them to destroy the antibiotic or keep it from getting inside of them. So in that way, those rare ones that have picked up these traits or spontaneously achieved a resistance mechanism are selected out, and they are the survivors. It's the Darwin theory of survival of the fittest. They have become the fittest. And this is where I see that antibiotics have sort of sped up an evolutionary phenomenon, because resistant bacteria that normally would have been diluted out by all the susceptible strains are being sort of culled out of the environment by the antibiotic, the very drug which was being used to kill bacteria.
Now, antibiotics are affecting us not only through the prescriptions that we're given and the drugs that we personally take, but there are antibiotics that animals take. And we ingest the animal meat and we drink the milk from the cows. How much are antibiotics used now for animals, and how is that affecting the humans?
It's been estimated that almost half of the antibiotics produced in this country are used in animal husbandry.
How are they used?
There are three ways in which antibiotics are used. First, of course, for therapy, when there's a disease. But in that case, you must realize that you not only treat the animal that's infected, but the whole flock, because they're at risk of picking up that infection, or maybe sort of harboring it. So in effect, in that one treatment, you're both treating the diseased animal and also protecting the other. So that's the second use, which is prophylaxis, like we often use and we use sometimes before surgery in human medicine. The third way is unique to animals, and that is growth promotion. By that, small amounts of antibiotics, less than the amount that would be therapeutic, are put into animal feeds to help them grow. This was something that was found a long time ago, and the effects of that on the health of the animals or humans who might be ingesting the food and so forth was not considered to be a threat. And yet, today we know that this subtherapeutic use does create resistant bacteria in that environment. The problem is not that these antibiotics get into the food chain, although this could be a problem. The FDA regulates that. The farmers, if they use antibiotics for any of these reasons, are not allowed to sell the animal until there's sort of a withdrawal period so that the level should come down. But the problem lies in the fact that resistant bacteria are being propagated in animals, as I was just explaining, in humans. And these resistant bacteria get carried on the meat and food products into the food chain that that humans are eating.
No, if we cook the food, we're killing off the bacteria, right?
That's correct. If we cook the food and if we prepare meat on counters which are separate from, let's say, our salads, then we keep out that potential contamination. And many of the bacteria are not bacteria that can cause you infections, but they do have these resistances, which, interestingly enough, can be transferred among different kinds of bacteria.
Before you've cooked the meat, if you're cutting the meat on, say, a wood board, a wood cutting board, the bacteria can stay on that board, and if you cut your lettuce on that board afterwards, you'll be eating lettuce that might have resistant, antibiotic-resistant bacteria on it?
That's correct. And so the advice given by the Department of Agriculture, the FDA, and others is that you cook your meat well and that you keep your uncooked fruits and vegetables away from the area where you might have this potential contamination. I think that this is going to be more and more important as we're finding certain kinds of new bacterial infections coming through the meat chain. And as you probably are aware, hamburger has been the culprit in a lot of these transfer of resistant bacteria of problems to human health. And I think the reason here is that most of the bacteria that are contaminating the meats are on the outside. If you're talking about a steak or a pork chop or something like that, we cook them outside, and the inside is not contaminated. We haven't mixed the meat up. In a hamburger, we grind the whole meat so that outside and insides are mixed together. Then when we cook the hamburger, we don't cook it completely through and through. And so the center of the hamburger is never cooked to the same extent as the outside. And inside the hamburger are still bacteria that originally were on the outside of that meat which was made for the hamburger.
My guest is Dr. Stuart Levy. He's the president of the International Alliance for Prudent Use of Antibiotics. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dr. Stuart Levy, author of The Antibiotic Paradox. I'd like you to explain what transferable resistance is and what that means for our health.
Antibiotic resistance has two features which involve transfer, and it's almost, in some extent, a science fiction-like picture, because bacteria, which are as diverse in genetic organization is, let us say, a cow and a pig, can actually take a resistance gene and move it to another one. And so you can get resistance gene transfer from a bacterium that might be living in the gastrointestinal tract and getting into a bacterium that might be infecting the respiratory tract, giving you pneumonias. bacteria that would never ordinarily exchange information are exchanging resistance genes. And that is in large part why we see this cascading spread of resistance from one type of bacterium to another. So that's one kind of transfer. That is the gene itself, the resistance trait itself, moving from one bacterium to another. Something that 30, 40 years ago, we could have never imagined. The other kind of transfer is the bacterium itself. And this we see examples of worldwide. That is a unusual resistant bacterium which appears in one country that we can tell by biochemical or genetic tests exactly what it is. And lo and behold, thousands of miles away, it appears again. And we know that it is transferred. That is, it has gone, being carried by a patient or someone who's just carrying it from one country to another. An example has been visitors or tourists from Iceland went to Spain, spent the summer. They brought back a Spanish type of pneumococcus into Iceland, never had it before. So you have both the bacteria being moved, and you have the resistance traits themselves.
Boy, those bacteria are really well equipped to survive.
It's incredible, isn't it? And they're so simple. They only have one chromosome, but they have all these accessory pieces of DNA that they just shift back and forth. But let's realize that they aren't doing it purposely. They just do it. And then if we add the antibiotic, we select out those rare recipients of resistance, and they then multiply. And as you know, bacteria can multiply every 20 minutes.
Now, I want to move on to another kind of difficult infection to treat, and those are infections that patients get in hospitals.
Sure.
Why have hospitals bred these really tough bacteria?
Each hospital has a certain amount of total antibiotic usage in it, and what happens is that certain bacteria survive that treatment and then lurk in the hospital, in sinks, in on certain surfaces, on walls. It's rather incredible. And these bacteria, like the Staphylococcus aureus, can then go back and infect another patient. So hospitals are now geared up to really scrub down these hospital rooms to try to isolate patients that might have this infection so it doesn't spread. The other way is, of course, to keep hospital stay short. And that is part of everyone's plan now, so that you go into the hospital for just the period of time that you need that hospitalization. And then you get home, we hope, at least this is what used to be, that the community outside the hospital environment would be free of so many resistant strains, and we would be then propagating and living in an environment with susceptible bacteria, which are keeping out those resistant strains.
In the war between antibiotics and bacteria, the antibiotics were winning pretty solidly for a while there. Are the bacteria starting to win now?
It's clear that the bacteria are definitely starting to win, and in certain cases they have won, much to our great concern.
So are there new antibiotics in the works that would kill the new, tougher strains of bacteria?
The present decade has two big problems. One is that bacteria that are causing common diseases are resistant not to one but to many different antibiotics that we would have normally been able to go to after they resisted one or two. And the second is that in the present decade, the 1990s, there is no new family of antibiotics that is going to come out. So we have to treat the infections we have with the drugs we now have. I know that we can do that and that we can find the right antibiotic to treat. In some instances, it may be only one that is left. But if we use that wisely, I think we can keep resistance to that drug back. However, if we don't make certain changes in this decade, that is how we use antibiotics, then when we reach the end of this decade, we're liable to see bacterial infections which resist all the antibiotics that we currently have.
What kind of research are you doing now in your laboratory?
We have here at Tufts University a center on what we call adaptation genetics and drug resistance. That is how bacteria, mammalian cells, adapt to environmental stresses. And in this case, in many cases, it's antibiotics or anti-cancer agents. We're looking at the basic mechanism of resistance. And when we identify this mechanism, we then institute a program to try to find new ways of getting around that mechanism or poisoning it. One of the major areas is that of tetracycline resistance. Tetracyclines are probably the second most popular antibiotic, but losing tremendous potential because resistance is so common. So we discovered some time ago the mechanism for resistance, and we have been doing in-depth studies of that resistance protein, the one that does the job, which is to pump the tetracycline out of the cell. And we've developed drugs that poison the pump and let normal old-fashioned tetracycline get in. And we're optimistic that this kind of approach will cause a renaissance, shall we say, in tetracyclines that will allow the good old-fashioned tetracyclines to work with just a little tiny bit of what we call a resistance poisoner or a resistance blocker. These are the kinds of ways that I think, knowing how resistance works, that is, human investigators, can actually work against the bacteria. We can use what they show us, almost like playing poker, show me your hand, and then we'll find a way of circumventing that resistance and come up with a combination or a single drug which will not be subject to that resistance.
So you think with a combination of solid research and caution in the use of antibiotics that we'll pull through this okay?
You put it very wisely. That's true. I think that we need research. We need more input from pharmaceutical industries that have left the field. We need government support of both research and development of new approaches to infectious diseases, all of which is very possible. And on the other hand, everybody who is using antibiotics, who had the idea that, gee, I could store them in my medicine chest and give them to Mary or John or my neighbor whenever I wanted, got to think twice about that. I'm not really doing the right thing. It's a good Samaritan act, I thought. But in fact, I'm not doing the right thing. And if I don't finish the antibiotic prescription, well, that wasn't a good idea, but I'm not going to make it worse by just taking what's left over and giving it out bit by bit to other members of the family, because I'm really doing no good and a lot of harm.
Dr. Stuart Levy is the president of the International Alliance for Prudent Use of Antibiotics and the author of the book The Antibiotic Paradox. He's a professor at the Tufts University School of Medicine. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Stuart Udall was first elected to Congress in 1954 during the Cold War. He thought the atomic bomb would bring us security. But after serving as Secretary of the Interior under Presidents Kennedy and Johnson, he investigated the damage done by our own nuclear tests and discovered the secrets kept by the Atomic Energy Commission. Udall became the lawyer for thousands of people who were injured or killed as a result of our nuclear testing program. Coming up, we talk about his new memoir, The Myths of August. And critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Kay Boyle, author of Herself, the new biography by Joan Mellon. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. South Korea has put more than 6 million military reservists on full alert. They'll participate in the biggest civil defense drill South Korea has staged in many years. North Korea has pulled out of the International Atomic Energy Agency. The North has been under growing pressure to admit weapons inspectors in to check its nuclear facilities. The North has refused. President Clinton is welcoming the Emperor and Empress of Japan to the White House today with full state honors. UPI's Carol Van Dam has this report.
With pomp and ceremony, President Clinton welcomed Emperor Akihito and the Empress to the White House in an elaborate hour-long state ceremony on the South Lawn, while 4,000 guests sat simmering in the 90-degree heat. The President and Akihito both attempted to accentuate the positive, leaving behind the two countries' trouble on trade. Akihito spoke of the challenge that lies ahead.
To meet in partnership the new needs of the post-Cold War era, and to contribute together to the peace and prosperity of Asia and the Pacific.
The Clintons host their first official state dinner tonight in honor of the emperor and his wife. Carol Van Dam, The White House.
A federal jury has found the Exxon company and former Captain Joseph Hazelwood guilty of recklessness. The jury says both were to blame for the 1989 Exxon Valdez oil spill in Alaska. The verdict means more than 10,000 plaintiffs can go ahead with a multi-billion-dollar damage suit. A fundamentalist Muslim group in the Philippines has released 20 of 21 Christian hostages that it has held since last week. A priest is still in custody. Witnesses say that a government official paid more than $7,000 in ransom despite a policy of not paying kidnappers. We have more from John Miller in Manila.
The hostages were taken last Wednesday when a convoy carrying 60 Christians was ambushed by heavily armed men on the mainly Muslim island of Basilan, 550 miles south of Manila. The attackers separated 16 members of the group and shot them at close range. A spokesman for the Abu Sayyaf guerrilla group said the massacre and kidnapping were in response to a massive military operation against the group's stronghold in a neighboring province. Abu Sayyaf is the most active of a number of fundamentalist Muslim groups that oppose a peace process now underway between the Philippine government and the largest Muslim rebel faction. The group has claimed responsibility for several bombings, murders, and kidnappings. On Saturday, about 20,000 people rallied in the predominantly Muslim city of Marawi to demand an end to the bloodshed. For National Public Radio, I'm John Miller in Manila.
A published report indicates that most Western Hemisphere countries increasingly support the use of force in Haiti to topple the military junta there. The New York Times is quoting diplomats who say several countries that were against intervention have changed their minds. On Wall Street, stocks closed up about 9 points today to end at 37.83. This is NPR. NAACP delegates are meeting in a closed session today to begin work on a new civil rights agenda. The group's chairman, William Gibson, is calling on members to develop a strategy to solve the problems of violence, drugs, and racism. Those attending the three-day conference in Baltimore include black business people, politicians, scholars, and clergy. Controversial Nation of Islam leader Louis Farrakhan is also attending. NAACP Executive Director Benjamin Chavis says Farrakhan was invited because there needs to be a fair exchange of views within the African-American community. He says the need is too great to shut anyone out. The military commander of the Rwandan rebels says his forces have captured the town of Gitarama, which has been the headquarters of the interim Rwandan government since April. Mark Doyle reports from the Rwandan capital, Kigali.
There is no independent confirmation of the rebel claim, but it is known that the rebels were advancing on Gitarama and that some members of the interim government had already left the town for uncontested territory in western Rwanda. The rebel military commander said he would allow journalists to visit Gitarama within a few days. General Kagame said that following the capture of Gitarama, he had several military options. The general said a ceasefire, which both sides have been discussing with the UN, was one possibility, but only if the government side met the condition of stopping the government militia from massacring civilian supporters of the rebels. Hundreds of thousands of people have been killed by the government militia in a genocide aimed at civilian Tutsis, the tribe from which the rebels draw most support, and Hutu government opponents.
Mark Doyle reporting for the BBC. The White House says President and Mrs. Clinton have been interviewed by Whitewater Special Prosecutor Robert Fisk. Both interviews were done yesterday under oath. Fisk reportedly asked questions about the death of White House Deputy Counsel Vincent Foster. I'm Corva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In the spring of 1953, the Atomic Energy Commission detonated 11 atomic explosions at its Nevada test site. The fallout spread over Nevada, Utah, and Arizona. 1 year later, Stuart Udall was elected to represent Arizona in Congress. He gave our atomic weapons program his full support. But later, after serving as Secretary of the Interior under Kennedy and Johnson, he became more cynical about what he calls our Cold War affair with the atom. In 1979, Udall left Washington to represent the victims of radiation in the Southwest in their suits against the American government. Udall has written a memoir called The Myths of August. Udall is the grandson of a Mormon pioneer missionary. Stuart Udall's father served on the Arizona Supreme Court. Udall's brother, Morris, was elected to fill Stuart's seat in Congress when Stuart joined the Kennedy administration. I asked Stuart Udall if there were atomic secrets that were kept from him during his early days in Congress.
The truth of the matter is that members of Congress in that period were kept in the dark. This was done deliberately. And we went along with this, the idea that it was safer politically not to know all these secrets. This put power in the hands of technical people, of scientists, of these little secret governments that we had organized, like the Atomic Energy Commission, the CIA, and so on. And they in effect, were substituted for the normal government process, which would involve full participation by Congress. Congress really was emasculated in a very serious way in terms of its participation in democracy.
Well, a lot of the atomic information was classified information that you didn't have access to. How did you feel about that at the time?
We accepted it as a necessary evil. It was just the way things were when I came to Congress. That's the way it was, and there wasn't much you could do about it. If you became intrusive, they would say, hey, why is he trying to find out the secrets? Maybe he's not a person who's completely loyal. This was the McCarthy era, and Mr. Nixon was part of that, I'm sorry to say, put a chill on members of Congress.
And do you think a lot of the information that was classified, atomic information, while you were in Congress, should have been accessible to you?
Much of it should have been. I've come to believe, looking back on my life and my career in the federal government, that we exaggerated the communist threat. We were almost hysterical at times. And that this, in effect, chilled our democratic processes and largely eliminated the kind of congressional oversight and concern which were normal for this country.
You left Washington in 1979 to represent radiation victims in the Southwest. Why did you decide to leave Washington and change your life like that?
Well, it was a personal decision. I really wasn't comfortable doing Washington-type lobbying, to be honest about it. And my brother and I had been personal injury lawyers in Tucson, and I decided it was time to go home. Senator Goldwater and I are agreed that you can go home. and that it puts a whole new outlook on your life.
You started representing the family members of Navajo men who had become uranium miners and either developed lung cancer or died as a result of exposure to radiation. How did you take on that work?
Well, I had been a congressman, and I had represented Navajo Indians. I had a lot of Mormon relatives in southern Utah, and they had to ask me to look into this and to find out whether something could be done. They felt there was too much cancer, and it intrigued me, to be frank with you. I realize now I probably did something dumb in the sense that I thought you could sue the government and succeed. I thought that the government would respond to the horrors that it had created, but I found I was wrong.
As you worked on these cases, more and more formally classified documents were released. Did you work directly to have documents released?
No, the usual procedure is to use Freedom of Information Act. We didn't have to do this because when you file a lawsuit, you then can force the government to produce some documents, although you never know whether they produced all that they should produce. But what helped us was that Senator Kennedy and Senator Hatch from Utah teamed up and they held hearings, and their investigators went in and pulled out a lot of documents. But my guess is that the great bulk of the documents are still secret.
What are some of the documents that were declassified that surprised you most?
Well, with the uranium miners, it was both documents and testimony that showed that the old Atomic Energy Commission knew at the very beginning of uranium mining in 1948 that unless they ventilated the mines, the exposure to radiation of the miners would be astronomical. They knew it, and they did nothing. And that's the most hideous example of the kind of deceit that the government practiced.
Now, you also started representing downwinders, people who lived downwind from the bomb tests and were exposed to radiation. How did you take on their cases?
Well, we had to, of course, as lawyers do, we had to talk to them and become acquainted with what they thought had happened and what they were told and not told. And I call it the big lie because they told these people there was no danger. And they said, well, we don't like what's happening. We're suspicious. And they said, there's no danger. And there was no way. They had no information. Their members of Congress had no information. So it just went ahead. But we were able to get a lot of documents. I still think some of the most damaging documents probably are still classified secret, about the tests and the size of the tests. And a lot that we learned was pretty shocking. You know, they in 1953, exploded atomic weapons in Nevada that were three times Hiroshima. Now, this was out in a desert, supposedly, and the people who lived downwind were 30 and 40 and 50 and 100 miles away, but they did it.
Now, did you know about this when you were in Congress?
No. I was just like my clients, these people. We had no Congress. There was no oversight. There was no supervision. And what you knew, you got it in the newspapers. And that was, they were doing this testing in Nevada, and they knew what they were doing, and it was safe.
My guest is Stuart Udall. He's written a new memoir called The Myths of August. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Stuart Udall. You lost your lawsuits. What were the grounds that you lost?
Well, we lost all the lawsuits on one essentially Neanderthal legal ground, and that is the king can do no wrong, the old English common law rule. The government is immune. And although Congress had tried to strip away part of that immunity, during the Cold War, federal judges and certainly the U.S. Department of Justice took a very hard line that everything that was done was immune, and that the government, no matter how horrible it had behaved or no matter how much deceit it had used, that you couldn't sue them. And that was the ultimate decision.
When you found out that you'd lost the lawsuit representing Native Americans who mined radiation, you were supposed to go to a meeting to explain this to the people who you represented, but you didn't even go. You did not want to go.
Well, I've explained this. I was devastated because these people had believed me when I said go along with the lawsuits, help us cooperate, and the government will respond. The government, once it sees that it has committed a hideous wrong that has taken the lives of people and devastated families, that the government would respond. And when all the courts slammed the doors in my face, I really was humiliated. What could I do after I'd said to them, believe in the law? Believe in American justice. I couldn't go because I was humiliated. I had no explanation that I could give them that they would understand.
In 1990, Congress passed the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act, which you helped draft. Was it your idea to turn to Congress to do what you thought the courts weren't going to do?
Well, the idea and the initiative actually came from a congressman from Utah and a senator from Utah, and I was so discouraged, and I just made the big effort and lost, and in the beginning I said, well, it's futile. And as a matter of fact, the U.S. Department of Justice opposed even this little piece of legislation. They fought it tooth and nail, and we were able to get it passed, but I considered this kind of a little miracle that we got it done. But it is there. It is providing something for these people. It's rather modest, but it's better than nothing.
What is your reaction to the radiation experiments that were recently declassified by Secretary of Energy Hazel O'Leary?
Well, Hazel O'Leary is my heroine. I think she stands out in the crowd in the Clinton cabinet. And this has been a very exhilarating thing for me to see this. I'm still not sure. I don't see, other than a little rhetoric, that the Clinton administration is going to open up the files that should be opened up of the Pentagon and the National Security Council and the CIA. The Cold War mentality, the Cold War culture, is very powerful here today in Washington.
Your new book, The Myths of August, is about the effects of atom bomb blasts and the Cold War. But another big issue that was, I think, very life-changing for you was the Vietnam War. You served in the administrations of Kennedy and LBJ. Were you expected, as you were having more and more doubts about the war, were you expected to not express them in order to be supportive of your president?
Well, you have to recognize that in those times, I'm talking about the 1960s, and this is true up to today, presidents really had this little national security apparatus, cabinet, and they saw the secret reports and the reports of the CIA, and the rest of us did not. We didn't even have clearance, and therefore all you could do is presume that they made the right decisions and be supportive.
Your son, Scott, was in the military, but he deserted the Army and then sought refuge in Canada during the war. Was that a turning point for you?
It was terrible experience. And this was just after I left the government. And he went in the army and deserted. And he went to Canada. And I went up to see him that first winter. And yes, it had a deep effect on me.
Even though you were opposing the war, I guess, by the time your son deserted, did that still go against your values in any way, the idea of deserting your military?
Well, my son made that decision, and parents, if they're wise, support their children, and that's what we did.
What is he doing now?
He's struggling with his life, and he's a brave young man.
Is he living in Canada or the U.S.?
No, he came back.
I'd like you to compare for us what you think Washington and Washington politics are like now, compared to how they were in the 50s and 60s when you were serving in government.
Well, there's been an enormous change, and the change has been produced by three things, jet planes, television, and money. You can't believe 40 years ago how wonderfully simple congressional life was. And I raised all of my money, it was a modest amount, in my home district. There were none of these PACs. And we came to Washington. We had a big family. We came and stayed. I didn't go home. I wasn't expected to go home. But this whole thing is an incredible rat race here now compared with the wonderful, quiet, really peaceful existence of a congressman 40 years ago.
Would you want to serve today if you were younger?
No, I don't think so. If I did, it would be with what I know now, it would be with the desire that maybe I could be there for a few years and help change the system. That would be my motive.
Stuart Udall, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Stuart Udall's new memoir is The Myths of August. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Terry, we're going to have a report from Mara Liasson from the White House. The special prosecutor took a deposition from President and from Mrs. Clinton today. Nina Totenberg has a report from the court where a woman in Ladue, Missouri, put a political yard sign out and her neighbors said she had to take it down. The court says, no, she doesn't. We have Robert Siegel talking about what will happen to the Lubavitcher sect now that Rabbi Schneerson is dead. And Michael Scholar has a report we've been waiting for quite some time. This is a long look at what has happened in Rwanda and his several visits there.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Until quite recently, Kay Boyle was one member of the literary lost generation who hadn't been found by modern critics. Boyle was born at the beginning of this century and became an independent woman determined to make a name for herself as a writer. And she did. By the time she died a couple of years ago, at the age of 91, Boyle had published 45 volumes of fiction and nonfiction. A new biography by Joan Mellon chronicles Boyle's remarkable career and investigates why most readers today have never heard of Boyle. Maureen Corrigan has this review.
Kay Boyle was known as an innovative writer and a great beauty. In a famous photograph, her friend, Man Ray, captured her wavy black hair, aristocratic nose, and heavy-lidded, seductive blue eyes. But the image of Boyle that emerges from Joan Mellon's mammoth biography is more reminiscent of the painting Nude Descending a Staircase by another of Boyle's pals, Marcel Duchamp. Like that painting, Boyle was fragmented, volatile, vibrantly alive, and impossible to live in the same room with for very long. According to Mellon, Boyle's turbulent history and personality make her a tough person to get a fix on. She was an avant-garde modernist who also wrote Potboilers for Money. She was a sensitive writer who narcissistically ignored her six children. By the 1960s, Boyle had become an activist. She marched with Cesar Chavez, supported the Black Panthers, and was imprisoned for protesting the Vietnam War. The only radical cause this pioneer woman writer refused to embrace was feminism. Go figure. As Boyle once dismissively told an interviewer, explanations as apologies for one's actions are a collection of words as important as a lace handkerchief in a slaughterhouse. Like any good biographer, Mellon indulges in post-mortem psychoanalysis, and she concludes, no surprise, that Boyle's mother was the source of her erratic behavior and her fierce literary ambition. As a child, Boyle was read not fairy tales, but excerpts from the novels of Gertrude Stein. By the time she was in her early 20s, Boyle was living out her mother's artistic dreams. She'd already left her first husband and was roaming around France with the sickly poet Ernest Walsh. Walsh soon died and left Boyle penniless to care for their illegitimate daughter. Then life picked up. Boyle began publishing fiction and became inducted into Parisian expatriate society. She was chums with James Joyce, Henry Miller, and Emma Goldman. She loathed Hemingway. Boyle also wrote for many magazines and invented what would become known as the New Yorker short story style. The typical Boyle story begins in the middle, explores a character's state of mind, and then trails off without much of a climax. During the 1930s, Boyle chronicled the rise of fascism in Germany. After World War II, she and her third husband, a Foreign Service official, were hunted down by the minions of McCarthyism. The charge? Boyle's lifelong bohemianism made her a likely communist. Mellon claims the witch hunts and the later hostility of feminist critics to Boyle doused her once bright literary reputation. Mellon's biography will probably turn the voltage up again. Though at 600-plus pages, I think it could have used some ruthless editing, the book makes an impressive case for Boyle as a key player in the modernist movement. And despite everything that's off-putting and contradictory, there's one constant about Boyle that's mesmerizing. In chapter after chapter, Mellon depicts Boyle writing, sometimes typing for 12 hours straight, through gallbladder attacks, childbirth recoveries, love affairs, and even an infection that rotted away part of her jawbone. After hearing about such heroic perseverance, you feel you owe it to Kay Boyle to read some of her short stories, to see what was so important for her to write down. It simply couldn't wait.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. She reviewed Kay Boyle, author of Herself, by Joan Mellon. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
If you live in a city, you're probably often asked for money by panhandlers. On the next Fresh Air, three perspectives on panhandling. We talked to a journalist who investigated panhandlers for the New York Times, a longtime advocate for the homeless, and a New York City transit cop. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.